Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Money is a human invention. There was a time when it didn't exist in any form and people got by without it. But in the modern world, it is literally essential to our survival. We need it to obtain food, shelter, clothing, transportation, and healthcare, not to mention the myriad things we want but don't absolutely need to exist. My guest worked with money in the abstract as vice president in emerging market equities at J.P. Morgan, but he's fascinated by the way money affects us in very concrete ways, in real life, and in its unique social and psychological power. So he went all over the world to study and understand both the origins and the future of money. Author Kabir Segal shares what he learned in his new book, Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. Kabir, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. Really a pleasure.
You say that part of your fascination with money is that studying it is a never-ending pursuit. Some people, that would put them off forever, but for you, that's a tantalizing idea.
It is. Actually, John Maynard Keynes, the great monetary theorist and economist, he spent 6 years researching the history of money, and he called it his, quote, Babylonian madness, because he could never really get to the bottom of it, because it's an infinite topic, and you can trace it to the very beginnings of life on this planet.
Ultimately, you visited more than 24 countries to study money. What is common about it across diverse societies, and what were the most significant differences?
I traveled across the world to look at the idea of money, and almost universally, there's an idea of money is used to settle and measure debts. So just as you think about a mile as a measurement of distance, money is really a measure of debt. And so, you know, I was in Japan, for example, and I bought some really delicious fruit for a friend of mine. These were really, really expensive grapes. It was $40 for one strand of grapes. They're delicious. Yeah, specially blended. And so I brought the gift over to him, and I said, this is for you. Thank you for your hospitality while I'm in Japan, while I'm in Tokyo. And he said, Kabir, I cannot accept this gift. I cannot accept this token of your generosity. And I said, well, why not? He said, you're going to be going back to America in a couple of days, and I'll never be able to repay you. I'll never be able to honor my debts with you. So I looked into it, and, you know, the word in Japanese, arigato, loosely translates to this difficult thing. There's another word, sumimasen, which means I'm so sorry. I cannot accept this. And so this idea of a debt is very onerous in Japanese society. For example, when you go to a department store in Japan and you buy a present, the department store will not let you wrap your own present, because if you do a poor job, it reflects poorly on them, on the quality of their store. But here in America, you can do it yourself. They give you the wrapping paper and you wrap your own present. In Japan, for Valentine's Day, there's a study that shows that 80%, over 80% of women buy chocolates for men they feel obligated to, called choco ungiri, obligation chocolate. So Valentine's Day is basically about honoring the people who have helped you. And then the men return the favor. When you go to a Japanese wedding, you have to tie that ribbon precisely on the present. Because if you do a poor job and you tie it too loosely, you may imply that the marriage may not last. So why do I bring this up? That's a very cultural understanding of gift and reciprocity and essentially money, because in America, we don't have those same hang-ups when it comes to debt and obligations. And so as I travel the world, you asked about the cultural attitudes. People have different ideas about what is the right way to honor a debt and what's the right way to use money in these relationships.
Makes me laugh, because we Americans are more than happy to accept a gift and not imagine any obligation to reciprocate.
Yeah, and where does the term Indian giver come from? The research shows that Lewis and Clark, on their expedition across America and the Oregon Trail, they had a difficult time trading with the Native Americans, because in some of these communities, the Native American communities, the idea of a gift, you don't possess a gift. A gift is when you receive a gift, you're supposed to pass it on. You're supposed to return the gift. Because in some of these communities, there's a spirit to the gift. And if you own the gift, it's you're squelching that spirit. And so a lot of anthropologists have looked at this, and they say gift giving is important to a society because it defines and shows the contours of the relationships between different people. And, you know, I work on Wall Street, for example, and even some of the big Wall Street CEOs, one Wall Street CEO keeps a list in his suit pocket. And on one side, it says people who owe him something. And on the other side, it's people who he owes. Hmm. And so we all sort of keep track of where we are in this gift economy. And some of us are more subtle about it. Some of us write it down and keep it in our suit pockets.
So for a long time, Kabir, scholars assumed that barter economies were the direct precursor to the development of money. But it turns out that what really led to money, and we're going back to this idea of obligation, was debt. How did ancient cultures keep account of what people owed one another, and how did that lead to the formation of something that resembles what we use today as money?
If you go back to, I guess, prehistoric man, you see that one of the first things that was shared was food, right? So when people went out to the hunt and they bought some, they caught some big game, some deer, some bison, they would bring it back and they would share it with members of their tribe. Because if they did not share it, there would come a day that they were hungry and they would not be able to partake in the feast, partake in the feeding session. And so very soon, this idea of reciprocity, I mean, there's reciprocity, this idea of reciprocity goes back into different primates, feel this, different organisms, not just humans, have this feeling of reciprocity, of like taking care of members of your tribe. And so you start to see right around, you know, when the Neolithic era begins 10,000 years ago, people start to trade salt, food. And they're sharing food. They're sharing different types of energy with each other. And so sort of when civilization begins in 5000 BC, let's say in ancient Mesopotamia, what's the first thing that's used is the first instrument of exchange? They're financial loan documents. So there's a big, rich history of people going to the temple and asking for a loan. It was denominated in silver or barley. And they were made on, they were made in clay, and they're inscribed in clay. And so you have a rich history of debt being sort of the way to facilitate transactions in the ancient Mesopotamian world. And it's not really until about the 7th century BC that coins are invented in Lydia, which is now in western Turkey. So it goes to show you that, you know, you're right, the economic historians have always gone back, Adam Smith, Aristotle, and they say bartering led to money. But the anthropologists go back and they say, well, wait a second. If you actually go back and look at ancient Mesopotamia, if you look at, you know, these 3,000 years of history before coins were invented, people were doing transactions with each other all the time. It was just called debt, social debt, financial debt. So understanding that is critical to understanding what money really is. It's really a way to settle debts.
And we've known for a while how clever those Mesopotamians were, but in fact, they figured out interest very early on.
They did. And so in my book, I talk about the origins of interest. And the word interest comes from the word mas, M-A-S, which some translations put it as a goat or a lamb. But ultimately, when you borrowed something from someone, you would borrow in livestock, and then you would repay based on the offspring of a livestock. So your interest payment would be a fawn or a baby goat or a baby lamb. And so it became this idea of interest of repaying something in addition to your principal begins very early on in the beginnings of civilization.
So we know money as a technology, right? It's something that we invented out of necessity, but it also has what you call a natural evolutionary role. Can you talk about what you learned about that and whether it was inevitable that humans would come up with some form of money based on some biological imperative?
There is an evolutionary role for money. When I begin this book, I went to a very peculiar place. I went to the Galapagos Islands to study the origin of exchange. People ask me, well, why did you go to the Galapagos Islands? Well, look, money is an instrument of exchange, but where does exchange come from? Well, exchange is really a biological function. And the Galapagos is where Charles Darwin went to come up with this theory of evolution by natural selection. So what did I do? I went to the Galapagos. I was going around different ecosystems with marine biologists. We went snorkeling. And what did I see in the waters off the coast of the Galapagos? I saw a sea turtle. And I know this is out there, but the sea turtle, and his fin was exposed, and wrasse fish were cleaning the sea turtle, essentially an example of symbiosis. And so all across different species, there's this idea of exchange. Like right now, you're exchanging with the plant. You're breathing out carbon dioxide, and the plant is secreting oxygen. And so this idea of energy is the first type of currency, is the currency of the natural world. And so ultimately, what happens is when the brain expands, we realize that it's better to exchange because we can survive. People who live alone aren't as happy, as the studies show. Living alone is analogous to smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. Increased levels of diabetes if you live alone. To be social, to exchange with people, is very important because it helps us survive. We can rely on each other. You know, we can rely on people. Like when you go to the department store, all this food is there. You didn't catch your own food. There's a division of labor. And we start to create tools to facilitate exchange. One of these tools is called money.
Money has an incredibly strong effect on our brains. And now we can scan those brains and learn exactly why it is that money holds our attention. What happens in one of those scanners when somebody thinks about money, is shown an image of money, thinks about losing money?
So in my book, I talk pretty extensively about this new field, an emerging field called neuroeconomics. What is neuroeconomics? It's neuroscientists that study financial decision making, and they can go into the brain and show you what part of the brain is activating when you look at money, when you spend money. And so what did they find? They found that just the idea of making money sends a sort of an electrical current through your skin. Your skin conductancy increases. They found that they've done brain scans of people who are high on cocaine, and then they compared it to people who are making money, and they found they're virtually indistinguishable. They've had brain scans of men, and they made these men look at naked bodies, dead bodies, naked women, and money. And what gets the most activation? It's money. So the part of the brain that activates is called the nucleus accumbens, which is deep within the brain, and what neuroeconomists call the subcortical region. What does that mean? That means sort of the subconscious level. And so a lot of our financial decision-making is made at the subconscious level. I'll give you an example. When you go out to a restaurant and you're seated outside on a sunny day, the studies show that you're more likely to tip, to increase your tip, because the sun puts you in a better mood, you're feeling more risk-taking, and you give a bigger tip. Whereas if you are seated inside or if it's a cloudy day, you tip less. And so researchers have gone and looked at this phenomenon across 26 different stock markets. I said, well, maybe this finding holds up across stock markets. So they went to 26 stock markets, and they compared 80 years of data between stock market returns and the weather. And what did they find? They found on sunny days, the markets were up 25% higher than on cloudy days. It goes to show you that even when you're not thinking about money, different forces are influencing our financial decisions all the time.
Kabir Sehgal is with us. He is Vice President in Emerging Market Equities at J.P. Morgan, and he's author of the new book, Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Kabir Segal. His new book is called Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Kabir, good weather is good for the stock market. And it turns out that in terms of our risk-taking, it's more than just weather. Our genes may mean that some of us are programmed to take financial risks and others are programmed to take financial precautions.
That's right. So these neuroeconomists, they've looked at people. They bring people in and they ask them to make financial decisions. But before they make the decisions, they swab their cheeks and they examine their DNA. And there's this one gene and there's two variants of it. And if you possess one variant of it, you're more likely to be risk averse, have fewer credit lines, and have a higher FICO score. If you have the other gene, you are more risk-seeking, and you have a lower FICO score, lower credit score. And it's really fascinating because it shows that, you know, in this one study, 93 points of your FICO score are influenced and shaped by your genes, which that's very statistically important because FICO scores, credit scores go between 350 and 800. And so they've even done studies where they separate identical twins, and they separate them and they ask them to invest in stocks, bonds, to make an asset allocation decision. And what did they find? They found that even identical twins who were separated invest in a similar manner. So it goes to show you that genes are shaping our financial decision making. Although I should say that it's not the only thing, because there are cases where if you have education or financial literacy, you may triumph over your genes. But you can imagine one day that when you get your credit score, there may be a section on there that says, how did this person spend and how did it deviate from their expected behavior based on their genes?
Wow. It also makes me think about, you know, in the old days, you had to take a blood test before you were able to marry someone. I wonder if it would make sense to do a cheek swab before you tie the knot, knowing that so many marriages break up over money issues.
Yeah, you know something fascinating? I brought this neuroeconomist from Stanford to Wall Street, and he met with a few of my friends who manage funds. And their number one question was, can we use brain scans, can we use genetic testing when we hire people, when we make personnel decisions? Because we want to know if these people are more likely to be risk-averse or risk-seeking. So I think the questions are already being asked among the professional investor class of how do we incorporate brain imaging technology in DNA analysis into hiring decisions.
What's your sense of what Wall Street wants? Do they want the risk-takers?
I think they do want risk-takers to an extent, but if you look across different hedge funds or portfolio managers, the number one thing is don't lose money. So it's risk-taking, but within a context of not being foolish. And so I think that what you're seeing is a lot of funds, they start to incorporate behavioral economics. I'll give you an example. One of my friends came back from Japan on an investment trip, and when he came back to the office, he was not allowed to invest in any Japanese stocks, because he was suffering, they thought, from the availability bias, that the more likely you remember something, the more familiar with something, the more likely you are to make a mistake or to inflate the probability of actually happening. So he got back from Japan, maybe he was more fascinated, maybe he was more interested in the Japanese stocks, so they just put him in a holding pattern. You cannot invest in the Japanese market at least for 3 months. So they're looking to root out behavioral biases among the investors.
If we were all rational in the way traditional classical economists would like us to be, then the markets would be a lot more predictable and things would rise and fall according to their true value. Why are we susceptible to behaving in such irrational ways that end up costing us in the long run and that don't require like a math genius to recognize?
In the book, I tell this story about Harry Moskowitz. He was the inventor of portfolio theory, basically the idea that you should diversify your portfolio of holdings. He won a Nobel Prize for this theory, for his work in economics. But when it came to invest his own portfolio, he said essentially, I closed my eyes and I went 50-50, stocks and bonds. And so even a Nobel Prize-winning economist was unable to follow his own theory, his own idea of how to invest. Why is that? Because the brain is not equipped. The brain is not equipped to do large statistical calculations. The part of the brain that, remember, that's involved in money, the nucleus accumbens, is really an emotional part of the brain. And so when we're dealing with money, it's not the rational part of the brain that's always activating. It's the emotional part that deals with fear and greed. So a lot of our financial decisions are driven by that, fear and greed. And, you know, fear and greed doesn't always lead to the best decisions.
You write that you cried on your first day working at J.P. Morgan. What was so awful about it?
Well, it was a personal thing. I cried because I didn't see that life for myself, that I started a company with my friend, a startup company. I grew up, I wanted to be like Mark Zuckerberg. I wanted to start a company. And so we ran out of money. My friend and I, we started a company. We ran out of money. And someone needed to get a job. So I applied to work at a bank. And I was there on my first day. And I felt like this was not the life that I had imagined. In the book, I write that I was hoping for a life. Michael Lewis wrote the book, The New Thing, about Silicon Valley and the startup culture. And I was in his book, Liar's Poker, which is about sort of Wall Street trading. But I stuck around for 7-8 years, and I got to travel the world. I was working in the emerging markets group, and I got to study money from all these different cultures, which culminated in this book.
Is there something about being on the ground and talking to regular people that teaches you more about how particular cultures view and value money than you could learn at the, you know, high level that you were operating at professionally?
Sure. I think being on the ground is so important to getting to the roots of an investment case. For example, I was in Mongolia. And I went out to the hinterlands, and I was staying a few hours with a family that lives in a yurt, and I talked to the family, the father, and he was complaining about the pension system and the social security saving nets of Mongolia, and he was giving me sort of the man on the street version that the government was abusing us and they're not taking us seriously. Yet when you meet with the Mongolian finance minister, when you meet with the professional economist, they say everything's fine. So it's important to get out there, and professional investors, I think, in the emerging market space realize it's important to get out there and talk to the people on the ground, because they're the ones that will show what's happening in that society. One of the best things to do is when you're traveling throughout the world is to talk to taxi drivers and say, what's happening? What would you invest in? Hmm. And almost all taxi drivers around the world, they tell me one thing. They all want to invest in property. They all want to invest in property. So for whatever reason that is, but they always have a logic that it's a good place to invest in their particular country.
We tend to think of money as sort of a gauche, profane subject, but you remind us here that the great religions of the world all offer some guidance as to how we should treat money and how we should deal with our debts and that sort of thing.
That's right. And so I found myself in the book, I talk about going to India, and I was in Mother Teresa's Home for the Dying and Destitute in Calcutta. And this is where people really go to die. It's really a sad and sort of tragic place. I went in there. There were many lepers there. And, you know, there were 50 men in this room, and many of them were quivering on the floor. One of them was sort of staring out into the distance with his 1,000-yard stare. But among these lepers, among these poor people, I noticed a few volunteers. I noticed a 17, 16-year-old boy from France. And I asked him, I said, why are you here in Calcutta? Because when I was 16, 17, I was growing up, I was trying to practice for the SATs and go to a good school. And he said, you know, Kabir, I'm here because of what the gospel teaches. And I said, what does the gospel teach? And he says, you know, even though everyone here is poor, they're rich in spirit. And I do as my religion teaches. And it led me back to the gospel of the scriptures. And 80% of what Jesus says in the book of Matthew, his parables, are about money and wealth. And, you know, there's over 80 verses in the Quran having to do with money. The Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Old Testament, there's many verses about what to do with money. In the Vedas, in Hinduism, there's all this these instructions of how to use money. So how we use money can determine the fate of our souls, because all the gods are talking about it. And so in Christianity, Jesus is very clear. He says, listen, you know, you should lay, in the Sermon on the Mount, you can lay up treasures, you should lay up treasures in heaven, but not on earth. And he goes on to obviously sort of say you should renounce money. But he says something very fascinating in the Sermon on the Mount the theologians have been trying to work out for generations. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body, and if your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? What is he talking about? So theologians say that he's talking about greed. Because greed is something you don't see in yourself, you see it in other people.
Hmm.
There's a preacher in New York, he says, in my 25 years of hearing confessionals, no one has ever said, Father, please forgive me, I am too greedy. It just doesn't happen. Because greed is something you see someone who has a better job than you, someone who has a better family situation, a better reputation. But Jesus is clear. He's saying that less is more, meaning that you have to give up the money in order to focus, because wherever your treasure is, so too shall be your heart. And I found this logic across the different faiths, that we're all driven by an evolutionary or economic logic. More is better, more, more, more. But when it comes to the faiths, they're saying less is more.
And it seems to be a lesson that people across different faiths and cultures have a really hard time absorbing.
They do. And I think, I mean, and that's because it's the quandary of, it gets back to a neurological basis. When you pray, what part of the brain is activating? Your prefrontal cortex, the logical, rational part of your brain. And they've scanned the brains of Buddhist monks who are meditating. And that's the part of the brain that's activating. When Rene Descartes says, I think, therefore I am, he could very well be saying, I pray, therefore I am, because it's the same part of the brain that's activating. Yet when we use money, it's that emotional part of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, the subcortical, the subconscious part. So it's really a struggle between in our mind. And that's why it's such a complicated thing. But I did find, Chris, I found the most fascinating scripture on how to use money in Hinduism. And in Hinduism, there are four goals to life. One of the goals is called Arth. What does that mean? It means you're supposed to make money. You're supposed to accumulate wealth because your family needs it. You need it. You need to take care of the environment. It is a good thing to make money. But it's when you pursue money, it will leave you hollow. It will leave you looking for more. And that will lead you to the end goal of Hinduism, which is called moksha, or liberation, detachment from money. So you need to pursue money in order to realize that you should detach from it. So it's a very nuanced way, and that this can correspond to periods of your life. So early in life, you're making money, you're accumulating artha, you're accumulating wealth. And then when you are getting older, you should start to renounce it and detach from it. This can also correspond to periods of your day. When you wake up in the morning, you can go to work, make money, you know, go into the office, go to the meetings, pursue clients. But in the evening, you should unplug and detach from it. And so this is the idea of, you know, less is more. It can be across your lifetime or even throughout one day.
1-800-933-5372
is our telephone number. We have Bruce on the line in Pantego. Hey, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. I really enjoy your show. One question I had, or comments, is ever since like the 08 crisis, I had really looked into studying about the history of economics in general. And one of the things I've discovered is one thing people talk about is how money is the root of evil, where I think it's actually money just a tool. And in certain systems, economic systems, we've always used money to exacerbate the worst in things like greed, because we've always talked about either capitalism, socialism, or in the newest time is monetarism. And maybe the way the system is being used, or what system we're using, is that's where it's money to emphasize the climate change, inequality, just a whole bunch of features. Maybe it's part of the system, not money itself. I think my answer off there.
Thanks for your call, Bruce.
Bruce, you're right. I mean, the 1 Timothy chapter 6 says, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierce themselves with many a pang. So people often misread this. They think that money is a source of evil, but even Jesus recognizes the sort of importance of money. You know, when the Pharisees come to him and they say, should you pay the taxes to Caesar? He says, essentially, yes, render unto Caesar what is his, and render unto the Lord that which belongs to the Lord. He's basically making a distinction that, you know, money is really an earthbound thing. And you know, to your question, Bruce, across monetary history, you see that the people who issue the money, they want to control the money because it's ultimately a source of power. It's a source of influence. And so, you know, I looked over 5,000 years of history, and there's so many examples of this struggle between people wanting to control money, the governments, the issuers, and then the spiritualists who say it's not the end-all and be-all. So I hope that answers your question a bit.
Quick question here via email from Kelly in Dallas, who writes, as a wildlife biologist, I'm curious, does your research point to money as a neurological proxy for food?
I think so. I think they've looked at brain scans of people who nap stone axes, right? So stone axes were the first really most important tool. They found stone axes going back 1.5 million years ago in the archaeological register. And Homo sapiens, humans don't come around. Our species doesn't begin until 200,000 years ago. So when you're napping, when you're creating a hand axe, it's the same part of the brain that activates when you're making money or you're seeing money being destroyed. So this is the tool-making part of your brain that activates. And what were stone axes used for? They were used to accumulate food, to kill animals, and to create the energy we need for sustenance throughout our lives.
That's a cool connection. We're speaking this hour with Kabir Sehgal. His new book is called Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or catch me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules, applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with one-time vice president in emerging market equities at J.P. Morgan, Kabir Sehgal. His new book is called Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Kabir, I think it makes sense to everybody that people decided on a limited commodity and turned items like gold or silver into money. But it's a big leap between that and accepting that a piece of paper could be a suitable stand-in for these assets without any absolute guarantee that that gold or silver would end up in your palm at some point.
That's right. And it took generations, you know, if not 1,000 years, to move from metal to paper. And I wanted to look at the origin of paper money. So again, I went to Karakoram, Mongolia, and that's, you know, in the middle of nowhere. There was a few goats, a yurt. But why did I go there? Because that was the ancient seat of the Mongol Empire. The Mongol Empire was one of the largest in the world, spanning between Burma to Hungary. And so I went there because paper money was used as a way to facilitate trade, as a way to encourage merchants to come to that distant land to do trade with them. And so the first paper money in the Mongol Empire was backed on silk. It was backed by silver. And so they started to realize that their empire was so vast. How do you control, how do you influence and make monetary decisions across such a large land? There's only a finite amount of metal in the world. So they started to create paper. Again, initially backed by metals. And so what happens around 1260 AD, Kublai Khan is in power, and he starts to He attacks a southern Chinese dynasty and he conquers the Chinese. And he has millions and millions of people coming to be his subjects. But there's not enough silver. There's not enough metal to go around. So what does he do? He severs that link between money and metal. He creates paper money. And he issues diktats that say, if you do not accept this paper, that we are subject to die. If you counterfeit my paper, we will put you to death. So he realized that the Mongol Empire could only be, there's one way to control it, you know, swords, bow and arrow, horses. But the Mongol Empire was really governed by paper money. And so that, you know, shows how paper money was used to rule essentially the world.
And of course, now we've gone really from paper money to electronic money. It's astonishing if you stop and think about it, that you can buy something as big as a car or a house these days and do nothing more than enter some, you know, numbers into a computer screen or simply sign off electronically on the transfer of funds.
That's right. And so the dollar bill is essentially, it's almost like an electronic currency, right? Because we all sort of accept it as money. But when you do a transfer, it's just your bank updating the account of how much money should go into one account, how much money should go into another account. But as you travel the emerging world, as I've traveled the emerging world, 85% of transactions in the world are still based in cash. And that's, you know, why is that? Because even when you go to, you know, when you go to China, for example, very, very few credit cards. In the emerging markets, that may make sense. But even in the developed markets, look at Germany, 85 million people, 10 to 15 million credit cards. Japan, similar numbers, maybe 15-20% credit card penetration. Why is that? In Germany, the word for credit, word for debt, is Schuld, sin, guilt. There's cultural reasons for this. In China, there's not much of a social safety net. There's not a social security system. They've actually found that in the territories where people have higher savings rate, the marriage rate is higher, meaning that you're more attractive as a companion if you have more savings. And so it goes to show you that, yes, here in America, money is increasingly electronic. It's increasingly invisible. But as you travel throughout the world, it's still very much a cash-based global economy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Akwesi on the line in Arlington. Hi, Akwesi.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
All right, my question is about how money and money transactions happened in the west part of Africa before colonial times. Was it just plain barter system, or would they have something a little bit different?
Thanks for your call.
Good question. I looked at some of the practices of money in West Africa, in Nigeria, for example. They have things, this is in all societies, but particularly in West Africa, something called spheres of exchange. And so what does that mean? It means that people would exchange things with each other, but in different categories. So if you're exchanging food products, you could only exchange, let's say, a yam with a potato. You couldn't exchange, for example, a person for a potato. Right, so there was different spheres of exchange, and so if you were to make a mistake, if you exchange one thing for something that wasn't redeemable, you would basically be showing that you don't understand the exchange rituals of that society. And so in West Africa too, it was really this idea of debt, of like we can honor a debt, you can repay your debt, but it has to be the right currency for it. If you owe potatoes, you cannot settle your debt in spears or in fish hooks. So they're really culturally, wherever you go, these spheres of exchange are really defined by the culture that you're in.
What do you think is likely to happen to money, given that not as much of the world is operating daily with electronic currency as the United States would have us believe? I guess, is there a long future for hard currency as opposed to the electronic exchange of funds, or is this the kind of thing that could turn over in a decade or two?
I think, look, there's a dearth of credit cards in the world. But in my book, I really make the case that there's an abundance of mobile phones. So throughout the emerging world, the poor people in India, poor people in Bangladesh, and in Africa, they use mobile phones as a payment device. Like the economists observed that it's easier to pay for a taxi in Nairobi than it is for using your mobile phone than it is in New York City. Because they use SMSs to transfer money. So money there's a mobile revolution happening where people are taking their mobile phones and they're turning into payment devices. And it has profound implications for the global marketplace, because now farmers in Kenya or Nigeria, they can now access the markets in a different way. Like when money was invented, coins were invented, poor people can then trade. They didn't have to rely on a broker. Mobile payments allow farmers and people who have been disenfranchised to arguably sell their products on the global marketplace. And I think that trend is going to continue to happen unabated.
Would we be physically healthier if we weren't exchanging coins and bills and things that end up in many different hands?
We would. Actually, two things on this. First, if you pay with a credit card, it doesn't activate the insula of your brain, meaning the anxiety center of your brain, as much. So when you pay by a credit card, it's actually less physically, mentally hurtful to you. So, you may say, well, I should be using this cash. But, you know, in my book, I talk about this study that if you use cash, make sure to wash your hands, because there's a study that shows that money circulating in New York and Manhattan, they found 3,000 different microbes on the bills having to do with staph infections and pneumonia. Even they found 50% of the DNA traces were non-humans, chimpanzees, dogs, even traces of white rhinoceros. So make sure to wash your hands if you're ever dealing with money.
1-800, you have to wonder how the white rhinoceros DNA got on money, but I guess that's a show for another time. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to David in Arlington. Hi, David.
Hi, great show today. I'm going to actually pivot my question to stay more with the conversation. Hopefully it's equally as substantive what I hope the other one was. But I've got a lot of close financial advisors and friends that really are convinced that Bitcoin, even if it doesn't succeed in changing money in the way that we trade, that it at least is a starting block. And I've got a question. You were talking about the Mongol Empire having the paper that was backed by the sword, so to speak, or by force. Do you think that the way that we use Bitcoin, and that it's not as expensive to use it, all the fees and the processing, do you think that will win out? Or do you think the fact that it would be so hard to enforce and to track, how do you feel about that?
Thanks so much for that. That's a great question.
Bitcoin, don't think of Bitcoin as a currency. You hear it on the news, Bitcoin is trading at $500, trading at $300. Because the government always has the power to say what is or what is not currency. In the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt, he basically, with an executive order, said people are no longer able to possess and hoard gold. It can no longer be used as a currency. And that's when the gold was collected, and that's what went into building Fort Knox. So the government can always say Bitcoin is or is not currency. The Fed has come out, and the IRS has come out and said Bitcoin is not a currency. It's treated as property. So you have to track capital gains. But what really is Bitcoin? See, Bitcoin will flourish as a technology, not as a currency. What is Bitcoin? Let's say I wanted to sell you my car, and the key to open the car was on my mobile phone. Okay, using Bitcoin, I can then transfer that key to you on your mobile phone, and you now own that key, have that key, you can open my car. Why is that interesting? It's because I transferred the file. I did not copy the file. And so Bitcoin is really about file transferring in a secure and authenticated manner. But that transaction, why does it have profound implications? Because I just transferred you my car without using a bank, without using a broker, without using a middleman. So Bitcoin is going to be incredibly powerful in disintermediating the intermediaries, not the government, because the government will always make the money, in disintermediating the intermediaries for file transfers. And anything that can be represented digitally, a stock, a bond, a deed to a house, you can use the Bitcoin technology to transfer those files.
Is Bitcoin particularly appealing to people who would like their financial transactions to remain obscure?
Theoretically,
the
yes.
The bad guys?
But, theoretically, yes. But remember, I think the FBI already owns 15-20% of the, maybe not 20%, 15% of the Bitcoin supply, because they've, you know, anytime there's a problem with an illicit group of people using Bitcoin, the government just usurps it, takes it over, says,
really?
Now it's ours. Right.
Wow.
So, I mean, Bitcoin can be traced, arguably, and I think it's the idea that it's anonymous. Don't be fooled, because the government tracks a lot of these transactions.
All right. I think we have time briefly for one quick call. JB is on the line in Denton. Hey, JB.
Hi there.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I have a question about the invisible hand, whether the marginal propensity to consume with people charging more on their credit cards than their income is, that multiplies money through the economy, and what you think about that.
Thanks for your call.
Credit is really sort of money on steroids, right? And so when someone spends money on their credit card, they're borrowing against their future income, right? And so you're injecting more money into an economy. That's essentially what the government does, right? How is money created to begin with? The Fed basically goes to banks and say, loan out, you know, increase your loan amounts, loan out more money. And so then the banks go out, loan the money, and that's how money is really introduced into society. So credit is a way of, and debt is a way of taking the idea of money and multiplying it throughout society. That's why it's such a, you know, powerful tool when you're trying to reboot an economy. What happened during the recession? We basically borrowed against our future and injected all this money into the economy. But the day may come, not just for a credit card holder, when your bills are due. And so the day may come for the U.S. government, for any society that relies too much on debt. To that previous person's question, money is both a tool for good and it can be a tool for harm as well.
At the very end of the book, you tell us you wrote a message on a dollar bill and just handed it to a stranger you met on your way to work, hoping that a reader of your book might encounter it. Given that we are unlikely to be the person who gets that lucky dollar bill, what did you write?
Oh, if I told you that, that would cut all the intrigue, right? But I did give it to someone. In my book, the girl did not want to accept it at first. It was an obligation. An obligation she probably didn't want to accept. But I think I hope that the readers of the book, when they look at money, they look at money in a different way. And who knows, you might see that message show up in your hands one of these days come soon.
All right. If anybody finds it, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd, I think. Kabir Sehgal is a former vice president in emerging market equities at J.P. Morgan, and he's author of the new book, Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. Kabir, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me. Really a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can send the show an email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.